Welcome to Social Work Stories, a podcast exploring social work practice through stories and critical reflection. This podcast is recorded on Aboriginal country, which was never ceded. We acknowledge the traditional custodians and cultural knowledge holders of these lands and pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. We offer a warm welcome to any Indigenous listeners who are part of our podcast community around the world. If you have thoughts or feedback for our team, or just want to find our whole back catalog of episodes, check out our website, socialworkstories.com. But for now, on with the episode.
Welcome everyone to the Social Work Stories podcast. It's good to be here with you all. I'm Mim Fox and I'm here with my wonderful co-host and gorgeous friend, Liz Murphy. Hi, Liz.
Hello, Mim. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our April episode.
April episode. The sun is shining, but it's got that nice cool tinge that I like, Liz. I love autumn.
I was pondering this the other day, like, why do we call spring and autumn off seasons? For me, they're my on seasons.
No, they're the on seasons.
Don't you reckon?
And absolutely. And now that, like, we're getting so much hotter in the summer, this summer I just felt like Sydney was exploding in some way. And I, for me, autumn just has that, I love feeling that cool breeze come through and just, you know, you're back in your jeans, life feels normal again.
You're not walking around like this kind of like exploded grape that's, you know, filled with moisture and heat.
Oh.
And now we can just have the chill of the evening. Well, actually, where I live, the big debate is, do we start lighting the fire this week?
Oh, that is such a good debate. I'm so jealous of that. I'm just loving that we're sitting here with actual cups of tea and I'm not feeling too hot to drink a cup of tea.
That is nice.
That is so nice.
That's nice. And so we can kind of huddle together now, Mim.
Yeah.
We've got our cuppa and we can encourage our listeners to grab a cuppa.
Settle in.
Settle in because I want to say for the first time in a long time we don't have a health story.
There is a bias. I mean, I'm sure our listeners have picked that up, that given that both of us, Liz, are retired health workers.
Well, this episode, we are actually moving out of health and into the non-government organisation, so the NGO space.
Yeah.
And this particular NGO works in the NDIS space, Mim. So that is the National Disability Insurance Scheme, for those of our listeners who don't know about that. But this particular social worker, and we'll explain that in a little bit, but this particular social worker approached us about wanting to talk about what this works like and to promote how valuable it is to use social work values and skills in working with people who are accepted into the National Disability Scheme.
Yeah. And so this is the NDIS that came in a number of years ago now. And it's been a bit of a rough ride for it, I would say. Like, it's not, this was a huge policy shift and funding shift across the country. And really came from a groundswell of both lived experience and services, and saying that we just cannot support people properly in the systems that we had prior, right? So this was about trying to level the playing field in some way. But there have been a lot of teething issues as we've gone along, and social work, I think, is one of the professions that has found itself really trying to find its way over the years.
And look, I wanted to say a couple of things that I heard you say, and that is, this is a revolution in terms of disability care that's being provided, right?
Yeah.
And what I wanted to say to the listeners is, when you hear about the complex needs of this particular client, unbelievable the amount of I guess health issues that this particular person has. Now, I know pre-NDIS there is no way known that this particular person could have been supported to live at home with their family.
Yeah, that's right.
So it, like, in that way, the fact that this insurance scheme can actually tailor services and support for someone with such high complex disability needs as this particular client, wonderful. What I want to say about the social work in this space, you're absolutely right, Mim. There's a whole bunch of people that have been working in there with, you know, a real spectrum of skill set, some probably not trained in this area at all.
Yeah, absolutely, that would be the case. And so when we talk about multidisciplinary teams, we're moving beyond just allied health. In the NDIS space, you will have people with teaching backgrounds, with physical education backgrounds, with a range of different degrees and life experience and work experience that they're bringing to these jobs. And all of them will be called case manager or support worker, or there's a range of different titles that don't actually speak to the professions that the people come from, mm-hmm. right? And so what I love about this story, Liz, is that this is a very grounded social work story set in what is really a very interdisciplinary non-government setting. And for those of you who are thinking, but I thought you said it wasn't going to be a health story, what we meant was it's not actually employed within the health system. It is a non-government organisation working with people with complex health issues and disability issues. So I think this is a really good story, and looking forward to chatting after we hear it.
I'm a social worker who's been practicing in the disability space for 10 years, primarily in paediatrics until the rollout of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or commonly referred to as the NDIS or NDIA. NDIS funds individuals living with a disability from birth to 65. I work for a non-for-profit organisation based in a community setting. I work as part of a multidisciplinary team with OTs, physios, speech pathologists, and more. The nature of social work in disability is incredibly diverse. I sometimes feel as though you're a jack of all trades and a master of none. I once had a therapist describe to me that social work is like the glue within the multidisciplinary team, the part that holds everything together and keeps things moving. You need to know a little bit about everything, a variety of disabilities, the impact across the human lifespan, the way that loss and grief impacts on our families, the barriers in systems and access to community. You need to understand the NDIS and the legislation, but also mainstream services such as health and education. I often feel like a detective, always trying to uncover barriers and understand my clients' needs and goals and really interpret what a quality life looks like for them. In the case I want to discuss with you today, I will talk about my client and their family. Often in the disability sector, we work from a family-centered practice. This means we take into consideration the needs of our clients, but also the needs of their caregivers and the family system. In the NDIS, you'll often hear the word participant used to describe the individual who accesses the scheme. However, in this story, I prefer to use the word client. Therefore, in this story, I will refer to my client's parent, primarily her mother, who was her primary caregiver. To protect the identification of my client, we will call them Alice. Alice is a teenage girl. She has a significant intellectual and physical disability. Alice is nonverbal and has extremely limited functional mobility. Alice is also nil by mouth, meaning that all her nutritional needs are met through a PEG, a percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy, quite a mouthful, which basically is a little feeding tube that is inserted into the stomach via a surgical incision in the abdomen. Alice also has compromised airways, which means she requires a tracheostomy to help her breathe. This is a small valve that's inserted into the trachea or windpipe from outside of the neck. Due to the buildup of secretion that she has in her trachea, she requires monitoring and suctioning. Suctioning involves the insertion of a catheter into the neck to remove the buildup. Again, I'm a social worker and I don't have a medical background, but as I mentioned earlier, being a jack of all trades, we often need to understand the disability and health-related needs of our clients. Alice, because of her lack of physical mobility, requires a hoist and sling for transfers. She has a power wheelchair to move about in the community in the home, a high-low bed, and a shower chair. In her home, she requires wide doors and large accessible spaces to be able to move around freely. Alice also requires a disability accessible van for transport. The current situation I describe, it was a Friday afternoon when I received an urgent referral to speak with Alice's mother, who we'll call Robin. The referral came from her physiotherapist. Her physio mentioned that she'd had growing concerns for Robin and the family situation, but during that day, Robin had expressed that she was experiencing some domestic violence at home, and the physio wanted to know if I could speak with her and complete a risk assessment to determine if they were safe to leave that day. I met with Robin and Alice on site. As it was a last minute appointment, we took the only room available. Robin was gentle natured. She was softly spoken and often avoided eye contact during our conversation. Together, we sat on small blue plastic children's chairs, crouched over a knee high table. The walls covered with Velcro words and pictures of animals and is brightly painted. Alice was not in the room with us. She remained in a separate room with the physio keeping her happy while playing bubbles and listening to music. While Alice could have been in the room, it was unclear how much Alice would have understood the conversation or if seeing her mum upset would have caused her distress. Robin described to me a long history of domestic violence between her and Alice's father. Robin attempted to leave the home 2 years ago. However, because of Alice's specific equipment needs and Robin's lack of financial resources and informal support, she had not been successful. The biggest barrier was really around the housing. Robin was feeling further isolated as Alice's disability accessible van was currently unroadworthy. It needed new tyres and a service. Robin shared that her husband had never hurt the children, but described the family as being on edge and constantly on high alert when he was home. She advised that he was unemployed and often drank throughout the day. He was easily agitated when the children all arrived home in the afternoon. She was reluctant to call the police due to her previous experiences. She felt that when she called them, they hadn't taken her seriously. She felt that a reason because of this was that she was an Indigenous woman, and she felt that this impacted her relationship with the police. She was also concerned about when she called the police, the impact that this was having on the children, reporting that they became heightened, appeared more frightened and scared. Robin felt that when she did call, she was often so distressed at that point that the police had made her feel as though that she was being the unreasonable one. Robin shared that she resided in a housing trust property. She felt that she had no tenancy rights. She advised that her husband frequently taunted her with that fact that he had ownership of the property and reminded her that she could leave at any time. Robin felt that he knew that she would not leave without Alice and that this was a power move. Robin told me that she'd called domestic violence services in the past and they'd offered her counselling, but felt what she needed was practical support. I could sense how hard it was for Robin to share her story, and I thanked her for being brave and acknowledged this. I was limited by what I could offer her at this time, as we are not a crisis service. I provided her with domestic violence contact numbers. I encouraged her to call the police. I suggested that she pack a bag with emergency documents, medications, and essentials, and have a place that it was easily accessible to grab in the case that they needed to leave quickly. Together, we also agreed that I would make a report to the child abuse line regarding the risk to Alice and her siblings due to their father's violence in the home. We made an appointment to meet again on Monday morning to work together around what community supports we could engage her with and that would be appropriate and accessible for Alice. We also agreed that we could explore funding options to service Alice's disability accessible vehicle. When I returned on Monday, Robin did not arrive for her appointment as scheduled. I anxiously called her and she answered on the first ring. Robin reported that she had called the police over the weekend, but shared nothing had come of it and the police had told her that she was wasting their time. Robin shared on Sunday evening she noticed that Alice's peg had become infected and decided to take Alice to the emergency department along with her siblings. At that time, I asked if Robin had spoken to a social worker while she was in hospital. She advised that she hadn't, and I told Robin to urgently request to speak to a social worker on the ward. A social worker was immediately allocated, and they completed a safety assessment, which determined that Robin and Alice were at high risk. After that, the hospital social worker called me. She commented that Robin was a poor historian, finding it difficult to piece together her story. The result of the domestic violence assessment ultimately led to a social admission. A social admission is when a patient is medically well enough for discharge, but remains in hospital because they are not safe or that there is risk to discharging at this point. This can be a challenging space as hospitals are often short on beds and want to discharge as quickly as possible, particularly as Alice's infected Peg had been treated quickly and would have been considered medically safe for discharge by the end of the day. I knew at this point it was important to try and get some traction and explore options for Alice and her family to be discharged somewhere where they would be safe and we could work on exploring longer term options. I spoke with the social worker at the hospital who had advised me that they were liaising with the domestic violence services and trying to seek alternate accommodation. I knew that this potentially would not be an easy fix due to Alice's complex disability and equipment needs. I suggested to Robin that we call Housing Trust Services together. When we called, they confirmed that Robin was listed as a tenant and that if she was able to obtain an intervention order, that she would be able to return safely and that her husband would be requested to leave the premise. I wasn't able to attend with Robin due to other competing demands regarding my client caseload. So that afternoon, Robin attended by herself to her local police station. At that point, she advised that the police had told her that there was not sufficient evidence to put an intervention order in place. Robin was understandably disappointed with this. I want to mention at this time that it was also distressing for Robin to leave Alice unattended at hospital. Robin reported that the times that she had required to leave the hospital, she often returned to find that Alice was in a soiled nappy or another time left in her continence aid when nursing staff reported that she had soiled her clean clothes and were unable to find her change bag with additional clothes to place her in. Robin felt that Alice was unsafe without her there. This is something that comes up for lots of our parents with disabled children, particularly those with limited communication means. Because they're unable to communicate or call for help or express when they're in discomfort, they often feel that nursing staff aren't able to appropriately attend to their needs. When I met with Robin again, I helped her to call Women's Legal Service, where she scheduled a phone appointment with a solicitor. Despite pushing for an urgent appointment, the earliest that we were able to arrange was 3 weeks away. After 10 days in hospital, I received a call from the hospital social worker. She advised that the hospital was going to fund 7 days in a disability accessible hotel in the city. The family moved into the hotel not knowing what was going to happen in 7 days' time. Within that week, domestic violence services were able to locate a disability accessible accommodation that the family could move into with Alice. However, the accommodation was over an hour's drive away. As Alice's vehicle was still not roadworthy, Robin did not want to take the children out of school, not knowing how long it would be until they would be able to return home or if they could return home at all. After the week had passed, Robin made the difficult decision to move into a friend's house. It was not disability accessible, therefore there was no means of showering Alice as they were unable to obtain a shower chair and the bathroom was not accessible. Robin provided bed baths to Alice during this time and the hospital kindly delivered a hoist and sling to allow Alice to be moved from her chair to a bed. I checked in on Robin frequently during this time. She always remained focused on the children, their mental health and well-being, and school attendance. Robin was always thankful when I called, and I wondered if it was because she had told her story and finally felt as though she'd been heard. Almost 2 months passed before an interim intervention order was finalised. We provided it to Housing Trust, who responded immediately. Locks were changed and the family were able to move home. By this time, Robin was tired and emotional, but thankful to be home with the children. She assured me that the locks had been changed and despite Alice's father knowing where they were, she felt safe enough in the home. I could tell it'd been a difficult time for Robin to share her story with me, particularly after her previous experiences, feeling trapped, disempowered, and belief that telling her story would not change the future outcomes. I often wonder if I'd attended the police station with Robin, if the outcome would have been different. I understand that police can action an intervention order within a few days, whereas accessing one through the solicitor to complete a private intervention order took months. I also think about this situation and I think about how Robin was brave and kept telling her story despite a history of feeling unheard or not believed. I also think back to the word poor historian and I consider the use of this and what it really means when we use this word. I think of the immense pressure and stress that Robin must have been under and considering the basics of neuroscience and the lack of ability to connect with our higher analytical thinking when really we're just in survival mode and how difficult it must have been for her to clearly and logistically piece together how she'd come to be in the situation she was. And how leaving any domestically violent relationship is hard, but how Robin's situation understandably had made it feel truly impossible because of Alice's high care needs, and how much more vulnerable our individuals living with a disability in the community are. I think it's a hard balance in our line of work, particularly in our conversations. I was mindful to never promise a result or outcome to Robin, not knowing if the systems that we challenged would be able to accommodate their needs. But I think of the importance of making sure that Robin did not feel like she was alone during this time and that I would be walking beside her in her journey to try and create a better outcome for her life and for Alice's and her children's. I think of all the systems that we had to navigate together and tried to imagine how overwhelming and stressful that this must have been for Robin. I think about my clients like Alice who depend on their caregivers to love them, to be their voice for them, to advocate for them, and the fear that the caregivers experience around what life might be like for their loved one if they aren't there to be their voice.
Liz, this social worker, she blows me away. Her tenacity, the way she kept coming back to this case, right? That she could have handed it on. She could have just said, okay, there's a social worker now in a different service or in a different situation. I'm going to hand it to someone else from another discipline. I'm going to let this one sit. She doesn't. She keeps coming back.
Yeah, actually, thank you for pointing that out because you're right. There was a tenacity that was absolutely required, right? Mm. And here was a social worker that just stuck with it. And listen to what Robin, the mother, was saying she required.
Yeah.
And so I think that was like at the forefront of my mind was she's right there with that mum who's actually saying, I actually need practical assistance. I don't actually need the domestic and family violence counselling at this stage. I actually need a home for my child who's got complex health needs.
Yeah.
And the rest of my kids. Because my partner's actually saying, you can't stay here. The tenancy's under my name. So here's a social worker who's one, tenacious, but also has a beautiful breadth of skills, who's able to, you know, have expertise in understanding the needs of a person with high complex disability needs, right?
Yeah.
But she's also looking at this with a trauma-informed lens. She knows the dynamics of domestic and family violence. Like
absolutely.
Here's a perpetrator who's absolutely using a form of control over this family.
By saying you're not on the tenancy and then the social worker finding out later on that actually she was the whole time. I mean, it's a perfect example of coercive control, right? Unbelievable.
I mean, the other thing I really liked about this social worker's approach was the tenacious advocacy that must have been going on. I mean, I think she kind of summarised it, but you and I kind of behind the scenes know that there would have been a whole lot of advocacy going on between the various systems who were essentially not supporting this woman in what she needed. Right.
Oh, how frustrating was the police response, Liz? I mean, that...
Just breathe.
It was upsetting. Like, I just thought, so this woman keeps being told that there's nothing that can be done, that her experience and her story is being downplayed, right? I mean, honestly, this social worker is the person believing her and is the person standing by and validating the severity of what's happening in her world. Mm. I just thought, I found that really, distressing actually.
Yeah, and I guess I appreciated her reflection
toward the latter part of the story where she wondered whether, you know, had she done the right thing in persisting with the going down the legal services path, or would it have been better to have actually gone directly to the police and got the ADVO? Great reflective, I guess, thinking around it. But anyway, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So there's a police system that she had to kind of navigate with Robin. Then there was a hospital situation too.
Yes.
So I thought that was an interesting, description of her role. Because as you know, like there's another social worker that's and health workers that have come into play in looking after Alice, the young person with the disabilities.
Yeah.
What stood out for me was, the reflection that she came back to around the social worker's comment about that Robin was not a great...
It was a poor historian.
Poor historian. And I thought, Mim, I haven't heard that expression from a social worker before. I've never heard that.
I've never heard that.
In health, I hear that with psychologists and doctors. Sure. But I've never heard a social worker use that.
My heart fell at that point because I thought, please don't tell me that it was a social worker who wrote that. Because if there's one thing we know in social work practice, it's the power that is in the words that we choose to include in documentation. And, you know, I speak with students about making sure that your documentation is grounded in your values, grounded in our code of ethics. So your documentation actually is grounded in social justice, in respect for persons, in dignity and worth, in self-determination, right? A statement like that undermines everything that this woman is going through. Instead of actually validating her experience and the chaos that she has been living within and the difficult, complex priorities that she is constantly having to juggle, she's being undermined and demeaned by the phrase, a poor historian.
Mm. Yeah. And I think the social worker was very trauma-informed in her thinking that one through.
That's
like
right.
Like you say, you're living in traumatic circumstances. Of course it's going to be a little tricky to kind of get that dateline or that timeline accurate, right?
Absolutely.
When you've got a sick kid in hospital with high needs and worrying about whether the hospital are going to be looking after them, at the same time you're worried about, am I going to have a roof over my head when she's discharged? And it sounded
and
like to me...
And safety for herself and the children.
And the other children. Right?
Yeah. And also knowing that actually the care that the child was experiencing in the hospital was not the equivalent care to what she would have received at home. Knowing that actually the care she provides is optimum care. But she just wants a safe place to provide that in.
And you know, Mim, I think this is the value of having a case manager like this social worker, right? So she can hover above all these systems.
Yes.
So, you know, in health, that ED social worker's got a little potted little view of what Robin and Alice are like and going through. Very, very limited. And then you've got the police, probably only get called when, you know, there is violence or it's out of control or whatever. Another little potted view of what's going on in that household. Whereas this social worker flies above it, right?
Yes.
And she's able to see that if someone isn't here helping Robin to kind of coordinate in these systems, what the heck's going to happen?
I know.
What busy mother at the best of times is going to be able to take on some of those systems, let alone someone who's got a daughter with a peg tube feeding, tracheostomy, has hoists and slings and power chairs? By the way, when I hear all this, I think I do celebrate NDIS because there is no way this particular person, Alice, would have been able to stay at home.
No. Well, that's right. I mean, actually, in the providing of all that equipment and all those services, I mean, that's phenomenal. I just and the ensuring of there being a case manager that oversees it all. I mean, this is the essence of case management, right? Is that someone is actually being that umbrella person, like you beautifully described, and being able to network the different elements in together.
And do you think I mean, we are completely biased. Let's look at...
This is an incredibly biased discussion, but that's fine.
So with that in mind, that is why social work is such a marvellous profession to be working in this field, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And the other thing that you and I talked about before we got on mic was this is a perfect example of intersectionality.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit more about that concept and what you saw in terms of this particular person's story.
Well, I think the conversation we had actually came from a discussion about, you know, often students think, why would I work in disability services? It's not a sexy field, right? It's not full of crises and the energy that you might see in, you know, some sort of hospital TV show or, you know, I don't know, chasing the ambulances or, you know, it doesn't feel that way, right? But actually it is intersectionality that brings about the point and the reason why social work is important in these roles. So if you take this case, for example, here is a woman who is not only caring for three children, one of whom has profound disabilities. She also is an Aboriginal woman who is experiencing systemic racism at different points in her life. And you can see that very clearly with the police and with other systems that she's interacted with. But you know, we know, Liz, that that would be a historical experience for her. That would be her entire life, right? On top of that, she is experiencing domestic violence, which means that she is isolated in her social networks and in her support system. It probably also then means that she has a financial impact around that. We know how far coercive control can work, right? So here is a woman who actually, if you think about all the issues on their own, each one of them is a difficult experience to have in your life, right? Each one of them produces profound impacts on your capacity to access services, supports, resources in this world that then improve our quality of life, right? But intersectionality as a theory speaks to us about how when you combine those things together, that unbelievably exacerbates the disadvantage someone experiences. So when that is the case, what you really do need is someone to do that umbrella, have that umbrella perspective, to be able to say, well, it's not just because one element or another, it's because this woman is experiencing a range of different impacts. And I can't help, Liz, as well with intersectionality, to be thinking here about the feminist outlook that this social worker is embodying, that the centre of this story is the woman's lived experience. And actually we are looking at the woman as a carer, as a provider, as a partner, as a support in and of herself, right? And bringing that focus back to, well, what is the woman's lived experience in the centre? And I, for me, feminism and intersectionality in this story as theoretical groundings actually play together. I don't think you can separate them in this story.
I think you're right. And I think, like, there is a little moment there that for me said a lot in listening to what you've just said, said a lot about this particular social worker's approach. This social worker had set up an appointment with Robin, right? And you remember, Robin doesn't turn up.
Yeah.
Now, there'd be a whole bunch of people that just go, fail to attend, get back onto my emails, or, you know, go for a walk at lunch. This particular social worker was able to think through all of those points you identified, and go, no, I'm ringing her because I need to check that she's okay because there's so much going on in her life. Thank goodness she did. Yes. Only to discover that, you know, there's domestic violence playing out here, the child's unwell and in hospital.
That's right.
And was able to engage. And I just think those small acts mean a lot in terms of, you know, supporting someone. And I think we're getting back to her point about this is why she approached us about telling a story. What social work values do we bring to this space? And I think that one was of deep respect and an understanding that sat underneath it of all of those intersectional points that you raise. You're not going to get that at the local GP.
No, you're not. I also think there's an ethics of care lens here on this case and on the example you just gave, Liz. I think, you know, when we think about our ethical base as social workers, we often think about the various principles, ethical principles. So we often think about social justice and dignity and worth and self-determination. And they can become labelling, just labels that actually don't mean anything. You know, you could just say a tick box. Yes, this social worker demonstrated A, B and C. But if you apply an ethics of care lens, then actually what's underpinning the practice the whole time is care for that person in the centre. And so that example you've just given is absolutely an enactment of care, right? She's not just ringing her, not just having the appointment because it's the next thing to do. She's having the appointment because there is an agenda of care. And so when that appointment doesn't happen, she doesn't drop the agenda, right? She follows through. She makes the phone call. She follows up. And I think in the rush and the busyness that happens in agencies, and I mean, this non-government organisation where NDIS is happening from would absolutely be in exactly the same situation, right? Massive caseloads, very busy environment. If you come at it from an ethic of care lens, then there's not even a choice. Of course you're going to make that follow-up call. Of course you're going to follow through, right? Mim, my final point will be, I think this is worth considering in terms of a career choice for social workers. You know, like how often we will hear that students have a particular career trajectory that they want to actually engage in. Often, you know, it can be health. Often it could be in child protection. I get a lot of students that used to come and do placements with us at the hospital that are working in the NDIS space.
Yeah, right.
And they go back to it because, one, they enjoy the work, but two, I'm going to be brutally honest, non-government agencies now in New South Wales are paying social workers more. There are career trajectories that weren't there a while back. And I think in supporting this social worker, I think that we actually bring a lot to the working in the disability space. And I would be encouraging of students getting out there on their placements, giving it a crack, but also considering this as a career path.
I hope this is inspiring people, actually, Liz. Like, I think it's really easy to kind of, yeah, like I said before, kind of see the bright, shiny areas of practice and think that they're the ones you want to chase. But actually, I mean, this story just shows how gritty it can get, right?
It does indeed.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, if this has inspired you, listeners, let us know.
Yes, let us know. And if you want to do what this beautiful social worker did, just contact us and say, I'd like to actually talk about why social work is a fantastic profession to be working in this particular area of practice. So,
and
if
you're wanting a bit of one-on-one time with Liz, she has actually been doing a roadshow, doing some quite in-depth story work with lots of social workers out there to bring amazing stories to this series. So, you know, if you're wanting to have an in-depth conversation with Liz Murphy, get in touch. It's the time. The time is ripe.
Thanks, Mim. And thank you, future conversation people. So
That's right. Oh, Liz, that was a good story, a good discussion. I feel like I went down a bit of a theoretical rabbit hole, but you
glad
know.
Glad you did.
You know, some of the stories bring it out. So that's good. All right, we hope you all take care. Have a good month. Speak with you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Social Work Stories podcast. All of the stories we share are de-identified to respect and protect the people involved. We create this podcast because we're passionate about building the global social work community and strengthening our practice, no matter the context. If you want to help us grow the podcast tribe and continue the work we do, we would love it if you can subscribe or follow the podcast in your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be sure to get every episode as soon as it's released. While you're in your podcast app, if you can leave us a 5-star rating and write a review, it would mean so much to us. You can connect with us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, where you can share our posts with your friends to help spread the word. And you can always find us at our home on the web, socialworkstories.com. The Social Work Stories podcast is made by Liz Murphy, Dr. Mim Fox, Justin Stesch, Dr. Ben Joseph, and Maddie Stratton. Thanks so much for listening.